You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, good afternoon and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. When I spoke to Harold Brodkey here in the studio, it was a couple of weeks before the publication of his novel The Runaway Soul from Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Since then, the book has appeared, and like any work of genius, it's been greeted by reviews that have been both hateful and adulatory, some of them even outraged with anger that such a book exists. Myself, I regard it as the most profound and original novel published this year. Harold Brodkey is the author of First Love and Other Sorrows and the recent stories in an almost classical mode. The Runaway Soul, his new novel, features Wiley Selenowitz, the hero of many of the stories in his earlier collection. I began by asking Harold Brodkey about his comment that his short story Innocence would not be the same if he were to write it today. And I think, of course not. This book is about consciousness, and it seems to be about a consciousness that can't, at any point, be a part of the same river. In fact, you know, it seems a Heraclitean book, that the first, you know, major meditation in the book is of someone sitting with his hand in the water and recognizing that every current is a different current, that nothing is ever the same from moment to moment, seems to be the métier of the book. Yes.
Yeah, it's even more extreme. Without saying it flatly, it proposes as the most essential universal, the universal presence of time, and it also proposes without being sure about it, that everything that consists, everything that exists, is made of time, a version of time, a version of an element of time. It's not just a case of proposing an Einsteinian constant like the speed of light. It's saying that the one inescapable element in all of creation is time, and then the particular mystery of time, which is sometimes called its restlessness or its merciless transience, is, of course, that the motion never stops, that the motion is indescribable. It's not like any other form of motion. It doesn't flow. It doesn't well up. It's extremely unstable, but the instability is rather stable in that there's this steady pattern, and there's also something that we can call a direction, although we don't. It's not exactly geographical. It's a temporal thing.
It seems to me that if John Ashbery, for instance, has entered an imaginary realm, you seem to be the poet of consciousness of the actual world, a world that kind of gives rise to emanations. His seems entirely to have fled the actual, whereas yours is a moment-by-moment reporting of things that cannot be known.
You're being too harsh on John. John was, I think, was in the Navy, or maybe it was the Army, but he was at Harvard when I got there. I was 16 and he was about, I don't know, 22, 23. And we both knew Frank O'Hara, and we studied some of the same things, and I think Well, there may even be a superficial similarity. There's an astounding subterranean relationship. The great difference is that John, coming from upstate New York and having almost as his primary element a certain kind of elegance, is literary or aesthetic in a way that I am not, although I'm often said to be the most aesthetic prose writer and the one least interested in politics or the most hermetic or the most self-enclosed. Nevertheless, there is, in comparison to John, there is this other thing. I think the easiest way to think about it, though, is where the allusions and references to meaning are within a certain kind of tradition, which is traditionally called literary, and that what I do is to refer outward to experience. But John is always talking about experience, the cup of coffee, the Sunday paper, the boredom on the weekend when you work a five-day week. It's just, for him, those things have no meaning. They're not primary. And what I'm proposing is there's this abundance of real-life meanings, and they have to be turned to unless you really do want to give up on the notion that life has any meaning or that life is worthwhile. John is deeply apocalyptic. However, I've been described in Europe as being the kind of writer you only get at the end of the world.
Both yield a kind of sensation of endlessness, because in a certain way the voiding of meaning takes as long, ultimately, as the unfolding of meaning.
Yes, but technically John shouldn't do that. The voiding of meaning, in aesthetic terms, should always be tied to an extreme technical concision. Because in order to say there is no meaning, you shouldn't then imply that the mere sound of a voice is meaning. I mean, too much of what John does is self-contradictory. That doesn't mean it's not good. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not an attack.
Mm-hmm.
But the Beckett's concision, as he becomes more and more clear about his nihilism or Gnosticism and the fact that there is no meaning, and John's taking on certain aspects of prolixity, Beckett is more honest in relation to the doctrine. And in John, there is always this waver that he's gotten tired even of the doctrine.
Well, Beckett does seem to be the only honest one going, the only one absolutely committed to his purity.
He's extremely coherent, consistent, and logical about his nihilism, except for one thing. He had probably the most beautiful haircuts of any writer. And, of course, he wrote so supremely well. He should actually have been influenced a bit by the way Ashbery has throwaway lines and things like that. Beckett was not really writing for the end of time. He was writing with some notion of literary immortality.
I'm talking to Harold Brodkey, the author of The Runaway Soul. When I first started to read you, my great excitement was of a writer who was going to not only locate forgotten moments, but describe the way in which they had been forgotten. That is to say, describing the act of recovery itself with all of its hesitations, and the great, to me, discovery of this prose style.
Well, they're related, those two things.
Yes, of course. But most of the time, when Chekhov, for instance, is writing, he writes as if it were perfectly natural for him to be Chekhov and for him to have located these moments that other people have left out. When you're writing with the full awareness that the excavation is difficult, that what is being described can't be described, that what's being described is not an event but the memory of an event, and that memory is changing even in the act of thinking of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're a good reader. Well, just to attack Chekhov for a minute.
By all means.
He, too, placed himself primarily in traditions current in his lifetime. He started out as a kind of journalist, writing these short comic pieces. And as a matter of fact, in one of the modern library editions of Chekhov's stories, one of the old ones, there's a translation of a story of his called The Step, Step with two P's and an E, in which he starts off being a perfectly acceptable writer of no great importance, but quite nice, a little kitschy. And then somewhere in the middle, it's not exactly abrupt, it's within a page or two, he becomes a great writer. And it's a stunning moment. And if you care about writing, it's one well worth looking at. But he had two notions about the sort of meaning you could convey in language or in dramatic action on stage to an audience. One was based on his sense of gossip, on how probably the Russian intelligentsia talked, which must have been extraordinary, since it also gave rise to much of Dostoevsky, after all, and some of Tolstoy. But then he had an extraordinary sense, as most of the great 19th century, I mean, he's early 20th century, but most of the great 19th century writers before him had, which is of journalism, this new kind of mass consciousness, which did replace religious consciousness, largely. So that in most Chekhovian stories, there's either explicit or implicitly a form, rather like de Maupassant, but based on a news story. Somebody's going to get shot. Somebody's going to get robbed. It's not going to be presented in a flat journalistic sense, but the melodramatic spine of 90%, maybe even 95% of Chekhov's stories is journalistic. It is based on news stories.
That's why I like those stories that Randall Jarrell isolated, for instance, Gusev, which seems to be totally un-Chekhovian. It's a dream story.
Well, that's where he begins to move into the 20th century, yeah.
Yeah, an astonishing, you know, piece of work.
I associate that story with Rothko. The last paragraph, there's this enormous thing about the color of this sky and the sea and so on. And at that point, he begins to broaden out, and the fact that it's not journalistic. So that's one of my four or five favorites. Another one called A Dreary Story.
Mm-hmm.
You know that one?
Yes, and I love Rothschild's Fiddle. That's another one I'm very fond of.
Well, that's too scary. But yeah, those are all stories where he moves into and begins to invent some of the 20th century genres of the story, but they're truly non-journalistic. They all do play on terror and lostness. Again, not explicitly so much as implicitly.
I want to move back into The Runaway Soul. Before we started talking, I said that in earlier versions of some of this material, I found an alignment with the published book. By that, I meant that for me, the paradigmatic act in this book came in an early story in which the boy remembers ejaculating for the first time.
Can I pick on you for a minute?
Pick on me.
How many books were you reading at the same time?
I was only reading that story.
Well, how many books? You see, for someone who reads constantly, it's nearly impossible to read one book. There's a sense where, even at a moment where you're reading one paragraph on one page, you're reading eight other paragraphs. This is partly because of the non-absolutism of attention and concentration and the way we know things, which is by comparison and through certain acts of memory. There is no other way that you would have read it. Nevertheless, in a certain profound ways, you're wrong.
Okay.
But there are other ways in which you're quite right. The relationship to the earlier material is very slight. Now, the way I write, and some of this is very conscious, this is a conscious experiment that I worked on for 27 years, I address prose to a different part of the mind or a different part of consciousness from the way most writers do. And I've always assumed that although critics and one's teachers have been a little obtuse about this, the act of reading is an act of enormous freedom. You close the book when you want to. Your mind wanders when you want to. You substitute yourself for any character in the story. You substitute your mother for that mother or whatever. What I do in addressing a certain part of the mind or consciousness which relates to language in a certain way that I call it an experiment, and it was. I mean, I worked on it for a long time and did experiment. With how people respond to spoken language and how they respond to stuff that they read. It's a given that the reader's independence, and this began as early a story in an almost classical mode, with the ending, make what use of this you like. And to some extent with Innocence, where it's almost a Lady and a Tiger thing, the writer doesn't claim any kind of omniscience, and he doesn't propose any sort of final meaning for what he's relating. He only proposes, he makes a claim of a more honest narration of a sexual event than he's aware of anybody else having done. But the reader reading the stuff begins to have autobiographical moments, mixtures of memories of recall, often comparative and often rivalrous. Do I remember as well as Brodsky, or was my life that sexy, or whatever? But these things are like, but these things are like kangaroo leaps, and you return to the text periodically. But you don't. It's very difficult under any circumstances with any text, the first time through, to really locate the text, unless the book is so ordinary, so cliché ridden, so consciously a text that can be identified at sight. You see. Then perhaps you can get it on a first reading, but in most cases a text is semi-invisible. I mean, the deconstructionist, the system is absurd, it's ridiculous, it's imbecile, but the insights happen to be true. Not happen to be, I mean, that's what the intelligence of the system is based on, the intelligence of the insights. And so when you're having these autobiographical reactions to the thing, one can propose one's own history, or the history of how the book came into existence. But that's not actually in relation to the text. What you know about Wiley, what you know about Balzac, what you know about KCRW, what you know about L.A., all those things come into play when you read. And to some extent, because you read so much, there's a certain defense. I've think reading is not only an act of freedom, I also think it's an obscene act, that at its strongest what happens is not a suspension of disbelief, what happens is a curious kind of interpenetration, which is extremely unwise. My metaphor for it is also unwise, but it's like swallowing a hand grenade. And if you don't really want your life blown apart for 6 months while you experiment with the doctrines proposed by a reasonably serious book, then you have various ways of approaching the doctrines honestly, intelligently, but without swallowing them in the rhetorical sense, you know, without being taken in or swindled. And that's what, and that's to some extent what I think you do. The and it's what I do when I read, by the way. But in this particular case, I think that I shouldn't say I think, actually, from my point of view, I know that I can't take the earlier stories and revise them and fit in the Lila, say, of largely oral history of my mother with the Lila in the novel, because I tried. God knows I tried.
Oh, no, no, all I meant was, you see, for me, just as in that early story there was a dime-sized stain on the boy's underpants, yeah, there's a dime-sized stain in my mind that that retrieval involves. And the book still seems to be about ever more sophisticated and unsophisticated acts of retrieval. That retrieval, the impulse to grab back that first coming, might have been too simple. By now, this
no,
is that, very...
No, I don't mean it's too... No. You're still practicing resistance. The way the novel works, if it works for a reader, is that it's cumulative. And by the time you get to Wiley and Aura in New York, if the novel hasn't taken you in into its world, then there are a lot of things that can go on. But the structure of the novel is relatively tight and fixed, and it precludes the earlier material. I'm serious. That is, now, when I read it over, and I've given it, you know, obviously, a large part of my life to it, so I take the book fairly seriously, and I'm willing to give myself over to reading it. Nevertheless, there's an initial resistance that I feel in the first 25, 30, 40 pages, and then further on, as the book begins to reveal its structure to me, I mean, I know the structure. You know, that there's another order or level of resistance, which I begin to suddenly start looking for typos. Try to compare this draft to an earlier draft. There's a level of functioning of the book that I wasn't very honest about when I was putting it together, which is that there's a series or even a continuous challenge that it issues. Do you dare look at this? And I think there are a thousand ways of not doing that, or a million ways of not doing that. And I think I do most of them, but I won't. I mean, I'll agree with you if you want to, because I do think it's a perfectly legitimate way of reading the book, but I don't think it's actually in the book, the relationship to the earlier material.
No,
I have to remember something. I wanted it to be there. I got had. Every time I took material I was working on and turned it into a story, I didn't know I was losing it, or I wouldn't have done it. Well, I had to do it. I didn't want to starve.
No, I accept what you're saying, of course. How to put this? What I'm trying to say is that perhaps a person who's read the earlier sections has been in training for reading the book.
Only really superb readers. Truly. Look, Wiley, to the best of my knowledge, I mean, I don't know if you said this as a kid, you know, cross my heart and hope to die. Wiley doesn't exist in stories in an almost classical mode. He almost doesn't talk. The only action that he performs is in Innocence, for instance. He's truly not a character. This is hidden from most people by the fact that the voice of the narrators in the various stories, and then the less direct voice of the author in the third-person stories, is technically interesting enough that Wiley seems to be a presence for most good readers. But if you go back and check it out, he's not there as a character. He's just not. You met him for the first time in the novel, and the character that's written in the novel doesn't spring from the earlier Wiley. Not only that, but the voice in stories in almost classical mode, while it's closely related to the kind of voice in First Love and Other Sorrows, it doesn't spring from it.
I'm talking to Harold Brodkey on the occasion of the publication of The Runaway Soul. I'm going to drop this one, except to say...
You have to say that you've never met such an argumentative and imbecile writer either.
No. You know, myself as well. You know, the idea... Lionel Abel in a admiration and elegy for Harold Rosenberg remembers the time he said that we fought for our ideas with every weapon that we had. We were our weapons. And it seems to me that this is, you know, an admirable form of life.
Lionel's kind of a friend. When I was first beginning to consider the possibility of spending time as an adult writing, I was reading the Partisan Review, and he was, you know, somebody I'm not given to idolization, but he's somebody I idolized for a while. And then I met him when I was older, and at one point he said that he thought some of the stories suggested that I was he used a very flattering phrase. And then he said that the characters were egoists. And then we got into a, you know, thing like this. But who isn't? I mean, Lionel's an egoist. I mean, he's one of the greatest...
Lionel shocked me. The last chapter of his autobiography, The Intellectual Follies, is in the form of a letter to me, which he had never mailed, which he mailed in the form of the book to me, to which I still owe him a response. So there's a certain amount of terror that I feel. Lionel is attacking the idea of happiness. I made the error of writing. He asked me if I was happy in Los Angeles. He fooled me by asking, and I said yes, that I was. And he begins this letter by saying, you say that you are happy, but you know, Plato tells us that the happiness of the clam is not appropriate for the human being.
Yeah, but Plato doesn't know the happiness of the clam. I don't even remember the line. The thing about Lionel is that for all of his intelligence and for all of his honor, and he's a truly stunning figure on the scene, he'll do anything to win an argument.
Yes, he will.
And I just hate that. But the thing about egoism in Lionel is that Lionel is an old-line socialist, simply cannot accept the fact that people are not interchangeable and that people don't all have the same sorts of traits and the same sort of drives and desires. He's got this enormously organized sense of things, so that if a young friend of his is happy in L.A., Lionel will not make room for it. You know, but that doesn't keep him from being one of the best readers now alive. But I simply can't agree with him that there's anything unusual in having characters who are egoists. If you have characters, you have egoists. And he simply won't make that step. He likes parables, and especially socialist parables, and he likes faceless noble characters. But he tears those books apart when he analyzes them. But anyway, I suddenly realized, of course, I was just fighting with you the way I do with Lionel, which I shouldn't have done.
No, quite all right. Because Lionel wins with me too, but mostly because I'm more interested in what he has to say than in the argument. You know, I'm an extremely passive character in the world. The great joy of literature really is extended passivity.
But the way you read is very active. That's what I'm saying. When you read 8 books at one time, Dennis Donahue does that.
I don't. I never read more than one book at once.
I bet cannot talk about a book without bringing in comparisons to other books.
No, that's not true. It's an effort, but it's not true.
But it is an effort.
It is an effort because I think that when I read a book the second time, and what I meant to begin this interview by saying is that for better or worse, this is a provisional interview because I suspect I'll be reading this book for the rest of my life. This, an enormous richness and strangeness. But my second reading will not be the same as my first reading. You've been listening to an interview with Harold Brodkey. We'll be joining him again next week to talk more about his novel, The Runaway Soul. I'm Michael Silverblatt. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. Technical assistance from Bob Crossan and Theo Mondel. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice.
Remember that Bookworm will not be aired next Monday because of special programming. And part 2 of the interview you just heard will be heard this Friday, December 27th at 1 p.m. Not 1:30, 1 o'clock this coming Friday.
It's the end of the year. And as the nights grow long and the days grow short, it is very comforting to have a Pooh Bear and his friends about.
So Eeyore stood there, gazing sadly at the ground, and Winnie the Pooh walked all round him once.
"Why, what's happened to your tail?" he said in surprise.
This season we're making all the poems and stories of Winnie the Pooh available on cassette exclusively for our listeners as a gift to you or someone you love when you make a special year-end gift to KCRW. If you've received our holiday mailing, please respond. And if you haven't, please call area code 310.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.